Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. About 20 years ago, politicians on both sides of the aisle in the Ohio General Assembly demonstrated their tough-on-crime credentials by enacting mandatory prison sentences and three strikes laws. Now, massive state budget deficits have inspired even conservative political leaders to advocate sentencing reform as a cost-saving measure. Legislation to reduce the number of prison inmates in Ohio is on a fast track in the statehouse. Joining us right now to talk about that is Bill Cohen of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Thank you.
And also Alan Johnson. He covers criminal justice issues for the Columbus Dispatch. Hey, Alan.
Hello.
So let's go back a few years. Let's go back down memory lane.
The way back machine.
I say it's about 1991-ish. They were talking about the three strikes and a variety of other things. What was going on back then, Alan?
Well, then, and in my memory, somewhat before that, there were there's a real get tough on crime movement, and it was irregardless of the amount of money, they wanted more tough, stringent requirements. They wanted to throw people in prison. They wanted to keep them there a long time. They wanted to make conditions tougher. They built prisons. They built millions and millions of dollars worth of prisons, and it didn't seem to matter. It was kind of a reverse crime spree. You know, let's throw them in jail, throw away the key.
I remember going back a little earlier than that, in the mid-1970s, I remember doing a story, and the hook of the story was Ohio's prison population has just increased from 7,000 to 8,000.
I laugh because it's now 31,000?
I think it's 50,000.
Oh, 31% over capacity,
right.
I think.
Yeah,
it
they
is.
Were built to house a lot less. Now,
you know, whenever you tell a story about time, Bill can always go back further than that.
But I mean, that was a big deal. Hey, we're 8,000, not 7,000. And then every year it was another story, more and more and more. But Alan, you make an interesting point that we did go through a building boom.
Oh.
We
Absolutely.
Did say, or at least legislators said, and they thought they were representing their constituents, we're willing to put these people away, and we're willing to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the late 80s or 90s, we must have built at least a dozen new prisons, hundreds of millions of dollars it cost just to build them. And then now, of course, it costs hundreds of millions and billions of dollars to staff them. That's the real ongoing expense. But back then, a lot of folks said, we're willing to put these people away, and we're willing to pay. Now, as you point out, Ann, now we've got budget crunches and just about everybody is rethinking.
So what about all the rationales, all the crime-fighting rationales for the three strikes and you're out? In other words, it was to get at recidivism. It was to deter crime. What about all of that? Is that now, are we going to have an increase in crime? Is the opposite going to occur when we pull back on these things?
I don't think that the statistics bear out that throwing people in prison for a long time actually reduces crime, because usually they're not going to be in there forever. And when they get out, frankly, a lot of them are just better criminals than when they went in. So I don't think that really bore out over time. The recidivism rate really didn't go down because we were having harsher punishments. So I think Bill hit on a key point is the conservatives mainly, not exclusively, were behind a lot of this to begin with. And then as the budget tightened up, it was a flip. They suddenly realized we really can't afford this anymore. We just can't handle the kind of drain on our budget that the prison system causes. So they began kind of edging back a little bit, and now they're way back from the harsh on crime standpoint.
But let's be real clear here. Let's make a real clear distinction between violent criminals with first and second degree felonies,
mm-hmm.
and the nonviolent guys who are fourth and fifth degree felonies, they're in there for drug offenses or for theft and so forth. This is where there's a clear differentiation. Few people are saying, let's go easier on those
right.
serious violent felons. Instead, everybody's saying, we've got thousands and thousands of these 50,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
They are really in there just for a year. And by the time we process them, they're almost ready to come out. And these are fourth and fifth degree felons. A lot of them are theft offenses, drug offenses, nonviolent. And that's where everybody, not everybody, but Democrats and Republicans alike in the legislature seem to be saying now, let's not send so many of those people to state lockups in the first place. Let's redefine the dollar amount, the dollar threshold that where a theft becomes a felony. So therefore, instead of sending them to a state lockup, we'll send them to the ankle bracelet monitoring or some kind of halfway house. Let's keep them out of prison in the first place.
There's a lot embedded in that idea, one being that you shift the costs to often locals. But before we get to that, let's talk about the two bills that have been working their way through. There's Senate Bill 10. We're going to have State Senator Bill Seitzen. He's a sponsor of that bill. We'll have him on in a little while. There's also House Bill 86. Let's take House Bill 86 now. What does that do? Passed the House. Now it's pending in the Senate, right?
Yeah, and I don't know every detail of it, but essentially it cuts back on the number of people that you would be sending to prison. Some of the folks Bill was mentioning, the nonviolent drug criminals, they're going to probably be diverted to some sort of treatment program. There is a lot of people like child support. There's people going to prison for child support, and I'm not in favor of people not paying child support, but when they're in prison, they definitely aren't paying child support.
It's like a debtor's prison kind of a situation.
So, and there are several other classes like that. People would be diverted from prison instead of going to prison. And then also there would be a credit for completing programming in prison. This is probably the most controversial part of it because people think this goes in the face of the Truth in Sentencing Law of 96. Was that 96?
Another big issue, right.
Because it would give people credit. I forget how much. Remind me, somebody here.
I think it's. I think currently, right now, you get one day off your sentence for every month you participate in some kind of rehab. Under this proposal, you'd get, I think, 5 days for every month. And as you point out, the prosecutors are going, this is a little. We're going too soft on these folks.
Well, and they're saying we passed a law that says if you get a 5-year sentence, you get a 5-year sentence. You stay in for prison for 5 years. Under this proposal, if you were in an education program, a vocation program, a drug treatment, some other program, you could get a lot of time off your sentence, and you would not be serving that 5-year sentence, and the prosecutors say, not right.
And the judges, too, some of them.
Some of them are saying the same thing. They're saying, you know, that takes away our leeway and our to sentence because you're going to give them time off from what we originally thought they deserved.
Another provision of these bills is,
By the way, Bill, I don't mean to interrupt you, but it's House Bill 96, just for the record. I don't want to correct myself there. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think there's a Senate bill and a House bill, and they're both pretty similar. Another provision is to let judges in individual cases, again, we're talking about pretty much the nonviolent inmates, it would let judges free current inmates once they've served 85% of their sentences.
Right.
So, again, we'd be sending fewer of these guys to prison in the first place. We'd let them earn more, as Alan said, earn more time off their sentences. And even, I guess, in cases where they hadn't necessarily earned their freedom, if judges felt that a particular inmate was well-behaving at least and had served 85% of their sentence, the judge could let them out.
These provisions, if they were enacted, or this legislation, if it was enacted, has been figured to save the state $78 million a year on prison costs. Alan Johnson, how's that figured?
Well, if you're cutting back on the number of bodies in beds, so to speak, in prison, you're going to be saving money. And it's if you're sending someone to a community treatment program, it is far, far less expensive than sending them for, as they say, 3 squares a day in prison. So there's fewer people in prison, and the people who are diverted to programs, they're programs that cost less.
So how many fewer people are they talking about, and how soon would that be achieved, that level
It would be over a period of time, and I'm thinking it was 6,000, something like that. Does that ring a bell? Anyway, it was several thousand inmates. Every time I go to a DRC facility lately, I see they say it has a sign that says we want to get down to 48,000 within such and such a time frame. So that would be at least 3,000 down from where they are now. But eventually, I think over a couple years, it would be more than that.
Now, go ahead, Bill.
Well, I was just going to say, as has already been shown, you know, it kind of we keep swinging the pendulum one way and then we swing it the other and then we say, oh, we went too far, let's swing it back. And, you know, I think it just bears noting that there is another side in this. You know, if you are a crime victim, I don't care, even if you, you know, okay, maybe the guy wasn't violent. Maybe he didn't beat you up, but he did break into your house and he stole a whole bunch of your stuff and wrecked the place. You are upset and you want this criminal punished. And you may not be real happy if state legislators move ahead with this proposal and say, oh, we're going to go easier on these people. Because as a crime victim, you may feel you've been wronged and you want people punished, not just rehabilitated. But I think as the crime victim, a lot of folks say one of the functions of the system is not just to rehabilitate and deter, but it's to punish.
Well, some people would suggest that in recent years and recent decades, rehabilitation has been the least of what's going on in prisons now. You made the point, Bill, earlier that a lot of people just are getting in there for a year, a little over a year, and that's not enough time to really let alone process them as inmates, but then enter them into programs that might have some rehabilitative effect anyway. Let's go to the community programs, because by shifting them to community programs, doesn't that also shift the cost to the communities or not?
Well, the state does have a significant amount of money that they funnel through to local community programs for community treatment centers and for halfway houses and so forth. I don't think they pay the full cost, but they do pay a very significant share of it. But keep in mind that whatever the cost of a day per prisoner in a prison is, it's much, much less, maybe half, maybe even a third of that in the corrections program out in the community. So, yes, but the communities are going to have to pick up. I mean, that's the whole thing of that's going on in state government now is shifting costs down to the local level. Now, our governor will say that we're giving you the tools to deal with that. I'm frankly a bit skeptical about what kind of tools are in this toolbox, but there's definitely a shift downward, and Ann, you're right. The communities are going to have to pick up some other share of it.
And there's another aspect to this. It's selling off of the state prisons to private prison operators. Does that play a role in the savings to the state?
Well, there are five or six facilities to be sold. The sixth one is a juvenile detention center that's going to close in September, so that one's a little iffy. But five definitely are on the block right now, and those are two of them are already privately operated state-owned prisons. They would be sold. The other three are state prisons that would be sold. And the idea is to sell them to private operators, and then they're going to have there's a mandated savings of 5% when the state contracts with a private operator. But we would then have at least five, maybe six privately operated facilities in Ohio at that point.
Just to be clear here, the privatization proposal, that's not part of these.
Right, it's a separate proposal.
Yeah, separate proposal, I think, in the state budget.
Right.
It is.
So,
it is, and there's a lot of controversy about that, first and foremost from the people who work there. The unions are obviously not happy about it because typically a private prison, if it has a union, it's a very different kind of union than AFSCME in Ohio that we have now. There's also concerns about security. There's concerns about the kind of prisoners they get. The critics will say that they get the cream of the crop prisoners who are not as difficult to deal with, while the state is stuck with the real tough people to deal with.
Well, the state says, Ohio officials have said that the private prisons will show guaranteed savings of at least 5% and have the same standards and safety requirements as public prisons. What if they fail at that? So what if they don't achieve those saving levels? Is there any repercussions? And also, who keeps track of whether they're achieving those goals? Who's inspecting those prisons?
The state has a monitor, a physical monitor in a person in the prisons, and they would have that, and they would keep track of those standards. I'm skeptical of the operation of private prisons and the standards, and they definitely pay a lot less. So if you're an employee, even if you get that job, you're going to be earning significantly less than you do working for the state and have fewer benefits.
Coming up, we'll talk about yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled about the California prison system, what kind of impact that might have on Ohio's situation, and also hear from Fairfield County Court of Common Pleas Judge Richard Behrens. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Start your day with local updates from the award-winning WOSU News team.
Professional organizer Brennan says there's more awareness of hoarding today, and more people are calling for help.
Most of the calls I get from the television shows, though, are relatives wanting to help someone else, and that doesn't work. You know, the person has to be ready.
Hear the latest in local and national news on Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.
And this is 89.7 NPR News, 67 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20 this morning. Showers and thunderstorms today, especially this afternoon, and a high of 76 degrees. Showers and thunderstorms are likely tonight with cloudy skies and a low of 60. More rain for Wednesday, especially in the afternoon, a high of 83. And more showers and thunderstorms Wednesday night, a low of 64 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. Yesterday, in a dramatic decision, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the California prison system must reduce its prison population by 33,000 prisoners in the next 2 years. As NPR reporter Nina Totenberg reports, California's prisons have been overcrowded for years.
California's prison system, designed to house 80,000 prisoners, housed twice that many by 2009.
The California state prison system is the worst overcrowded system that I have seen in my experience.
Wayne Scott, who headed the Texas prison system under then-Governor George Bush, was one of many expert witnesses called in to look at California's system. That was after 20 years of litigation and failure by the state to achieve reforms it had agreed upon.
In the majority opinion, Justice Anthony Kennedy ruled there is no possibility the state can build itself out of its overcrowding problem given the state's continuing budgetary problems. Sounds familiar. So the state will have to choose a combination of other methods and maybe even release nonviolent prisoners to reduce the state prison population. What kind of ramifications could this have for Ohio, Alan Jensen?
This is the nightmare that Ohio officials have been having in their sleep for quite a long time now, that they would get to the position where they were forced by the courts to release prisoners. They've realized that that's not necessarily an imminent possibility, but a possibility. And so now they're trying things like we've just been talking about in the previous few minutes to avoid having the courts come in and say, listen, you're not doing this well, you're not treating the prisoners constitutionally, and we need to do something about it. And they're afraid. They're definitely afraid of repercussions of something exactly like this.
I'm pretty sure that decades ago we went through something similar with the ACLU suing or prisoner rights groups suing. Now, it may not have been totally on an overall overcrowding issue, but I think
I think it was on medical care.
Okay, but I also remember there were at least threats or actual suits saying, you know, you can't double bunk or you can triple bunk. I know the old Ohio Penn right here in Columbus, the conditions were so bad there. That was the subject of a suit. Part of that was overcrowding. Part of it was just terrible conditions, and that eventually forced the state to close that down. So court action, it certainly gets the attention of legislators and state officials.
We're talking about prison sentencing reforms. Some say it's a necessity if the state wants to save tens of millions of dollars a year and also perhaps avoid higher court sanctions. But in the process, the reforms could affect the power of common pleas judges in Ohio to decide punishment. Joining us now to talk about that is Fairfield County Common Pleas Judge Richard Behrens. Welcome to the show, Judge.
Thank you, Ann. It's good to be with you this morning.
Representative Lynn Slaby of Akron, he's a former judge and prosecutor. He said that if he was wearing either of those hats right now, he would say vote no on House Bill 96. He said that it takes away too much discretion. Of course, he's saying vote yes on it now. But what kind of discretion does it take away?
Well, one of the main concerns that I have is the discretion that is taken away from common pleas judges to impose prison sentences on certain felony offenders, such as offenders who commit felony 5 and felony 4 property and other offenses. And, I should say that, I believe that the legislators are well-intended here. They are seeking to get to a point where they want to use the public resources wisely. But I have to disagree largely on their proposal to limit the discretion of judges to make the sentencing decisions in the courtroom, where the judges have at their disposal all of the facts and the purposes and principles of sentencing at mind when they make those sentencing decisions.
At that level, the felony 4 and felony 5, those are usually theft or vandalism type of offenses, right? Typically?
Those would be typically theft and property-related offenses, some drug possession, perhaps even drug trafficking offenses. And I believe the latest version of this legislation that I've seen indicates that those offenders who must be placed on community control can only be individuals who do not have a prior felony record. But I would make this distinction that not every first-time felony offender is the same as every other first-time felony offender. I've seen in my years on the bench and practicing law for 18 years prior to that, that there are many individuals who go through municipal court on lesser charges, on misdemeanor charges, time and time again, receiving such sanctions as time in the county jail and municipal court probation. Then that offender will commit a felony offense for the first time. And I draw a distinction between that offender who's been through the court system many times before on a lesser level, mm-hmm. versus the true first-time offender who's never been through the court system before and who would typically receive probation. I believe that the person who has been through the court system before, who has served time in the county jail, been on probation, may need an additional experience or at least the threat of the possibility of going to prison to deter them from future criminal behavior. And that is what is going to be lacking if this legislation passes.
Judges, this is Alan Johnson. It's good to have a real-life judge on here we can ask some questions to. So much of what we do in the cover in the legislature, we hear the politicians talk about what they want to do, and we don't hear from people out in the trenches, so I appreciate it. Could you be a little more specific about what you're concerned with, about your limitations or taking away from your leeway in sentencing? Are you afraid that people who have more serious offenses are going to be either put in community programs or maybe set free or have limited sanctions and it's going to be a problem in the community? Could you elaborate a little bit?
Well, part of it is what I've already referred to is that you have certain offenders who have already been on this revolving door in and out of the county jail on lesser misdemeanor offenses, and then they come before the court, say for the eighth time, but now it's a felony theft offense. Under this legislation, the court's hands would be tied. The only thing the court could do at sentencing is place them on community control. The court could place them in the county jail, which they've already, in all likelihood, experienced, and place them on community control, probation, which they've already experienced. So it's not going to be anything different than what they've experienced before. So my concern is basically how can the court meet their obligation to serve the purposes and principles of sentencing, one of which is to deter offenders from crimes in the future. Just because a person commits a nonviolent property offense does not mean that they could not benefit greatly from going to prison, at least for a brief period of time, to give them that experience, to get their priorities straight. I hear time and time again from offenders that, they've served time in the county jail before, but after they've been to prison and they come back before the court, they tell me that this was a whole different experience. I never want to go back there again. And, I've seen it play out time and time again. It truly has a deterrent effect.
Judge, aren't there limits on, particularly for first-time felony offenders, regardless of what their misdemeanor history might be, of how long you can sentence them to prison? And so many of them go to prison for such a short period of time. while it may be a source of punishment, it's not necessarily a place where they're rehabilitated or can take advantage of any kinds of programming?
Well, in my experience and in speaking with a large number of Collin Police Court judges throughout the state, many judges who sentence the felony 5 and felony 4 offenders to prison are not sending them to prison right off the bat. There may be some circumstances where that does occur, but I would venture to say that, and I've seen the Council of State Governments report indicates that there was, I think, 10,000 fourth and fifth degree offenders of this type in the state prison, and that their average sentence was about 9 months. But I'd venture to say that many of those were individuals who were initially placed on probation, on community control, and then violated their community control in some way.
Your point is that these people have already been given a second chance and a third chance, and that's why you want to, at some point, say enough is enough.
Exactly. And it's taking away a tool that I think that the judges need to retain if our job is to make those kind of decisions in the courtroom.
My guests are Bill Cohen from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and also Alan Johnson from the Columbus Dispatch, and Richard Behrens from the Fairfield County Court of Common Pleas. If you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Bill Cohen?
Judge, as you know, this proposal legislators are looking at would give judges in individual cases the authority to free current inmates once they've served 85% of their sentence. Do you think you would take advantage of that to do much of that kind of thing? Or not?
I believe what you're referring to is what's known as the earned credit provision in this legislation.
Well, I think there's a separate. I think that's a separate provision, though. I know there is the earned credit where you could get more days off your sentence, but I thought there's another provision that gives judges the power to go in and say, "Hey, here's an inmate. They served 85% of their sentence. Let's let this guy out."
I believe that's what you're referring to, what's known as a risk reduction sentence.
Okay, yep.
Where at the time of sentencing, the judge can tell the offender, okay, I'm going to sentence you to, 18 months in prison, but I'm also going to impose a risk reduction sentence to this so to give you an incentive so that during the course of your incarceration, you take advantage of available resources and programming while in prison. Yes, I'm very much in favor of that. I commonly, my purpose in sentencing is twofold: to punishment in order to provide that measure of deterrence, and also some measure of rehabilitation, because I've seen the rehabilitation take place in prison, and I think the more of that we can do, the better. Now, I do have one objection to the risk reduction as it presently exists in the proposal, and that is that at the present time, as it's presently drafted, this risk reduction sentence provision would require the agreement of the prosecutor and the defendant before the judge could order the risk reduction sentence. And I believe that is inappropriate, that the court should have the authority without needing the consent of the prosecutor. And of course, the defendant, I can't imagine a situation where a defendant would not want a risk reduction sentence.
Right.
But I don't believe it's appropriate that the prosecutor should have power over the court's ability to decide the sentence.
Judge, you recommend... I'm sorry.
I was going to say it's a violation of the separation of powers, in my opinion.
You've recommended that a felony enhancement provision for repeat offenders of certain misdemeanors be considered. What's a felony enhancement, and can you give me an example?
Well, this is a provision that existed in state law prior to 1996 when there were some other amendments to the state criminal code. That were put into effect. And what used to be the law is that if an individual was charged with a theft offense, and if that was a misdemeanor theft offense, the next time that that person was charged with a theft offense, that offender could be charged with a felony because it was the second time around. And again, it goes back to my overriding concern that that our court sees many repeat offenders committing the same type of behavior. So I would recommend that we go back to the laws that existed prior to 1996 to give the prosecutors the discretion to decide, do we need to charge this multiple offender with a felony or is a misdemeanor offense appropriate, and give the courts the ability to make that distinction as well. As it exists now, a person could go into, say, for example, Kmart and steal 20 times and shoplift 20 times. As long as the amount of property involved was less than $500, that would always be a misdemeanor. It could never be a felony. So that's one concern I have about that, is it goes to the repeat offenders.
Judge, would it be your stand as a judge that judges should not take into account prison overcrowding when they sentence somebody, that really that's a separate issue and you should just kind of keep your eyes on what's the best punishment, what's the best rehabilitation, that really that, at least as far as you're concerned, overcrowding should not soften whatever you do? Would that be your stand?
Yes, I think that would accurately, you know, summarize my overriding view on this issue. Although, I join with the legislature and the legislators and such as Senator Seitz and Smith that, you know, we have to, as a state, we have to make good policy decisions. We have to decide how are we best going to use our limited resources in these tough economic times. But I don't believe for myself that it's appropriate for me to necessarily, you know, make that a top priority when I go to about making a decision as to where and for how long to send an individual for incarceration. I believe that's the obligation of the executive branch to provide that for the courts and for the community.
Judge Behrens, on the other hand, if they increase the use of community sanctions and community resources, are you concerned about what the impact might be locally? Would the courts have to assume any of that expense?
Not directly, and that would not be our responsibility, you know, to provide for example, increased county jail space if we're going to have all of these low-level felony 5 and felony 4 offenders serving time in the county jail. It's the county sheriff and the county commissioners ultimately are responsible for providing jail space. As far as the community resources such as community-based correctional facilities, those are state-run facilities that would have to be funded by the state of Ohio.
Judge, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Appreciate it. That's Judge Richard Behrens of the Fairfield County Common Pleas Court. When we return, we'll hear from Bill Seitz. He's the state senator from the Cincinnati area who is sponsoring Senate Bill 10. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Listen to local news from the award-winning WOSU News Team and national news from NPR on the new 89.7 NPR News. And be sure to enjoy the best in classical music on the new Classical 101. Classical music all day, every day. It's all news on 89.7 NPR News and all classical on Classical 101. For more information and to stream our services online, visit WOSU.org.
And this is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of the program begins. And A Singular Woman, Understanding the Mother of Our President, with author Janie Scott. Join us for that beginning at 11 on All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Support for 89.7 comes from Columbus College of Art and Design. Creative futures begin in Saturday morning art classes for children and youth starting in June. Information and online registration at www.ccad.edu.
67 degrees in downtown Columbus. Cloudy skies today. Expect showers and pop-up thunderstorms this afternoon, a high of 76. There's still that chance of showers and thunderstorms tonight, a low of 60 degrees. And showers and thunderstorms are likely in the afternoon for Wednesday, a high of 83. Also a chance of rain Wednesday night and a chance of rain for Thursday. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about plans to overhaul the state's criminal sentencing code. Joining us now is one of the authors of the legislation pending in the Ohio General Assembly, State Senator Bill Seitz. Senator Seitz serves on the Judiciary Civil Justice Committee. He's a partner in the law firm in Cincinnati, and he co-chairs the Civil Justice Task Force of the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. Welcome to the show, Senator.
Thanks, Ann. Happy to be with you today.
Senate Bill 10 increases the monetary threshold to define a felony offense or theft of vandalism. It also dictates how judges sentence people convicted of fourth or fifth degree felonies. Do you feel good about this? Does this changing and taking away the judge's discretion in these kinds of cases?
No, it really isn't. This legislation is long overdue and has actually been percolating for almost 3 years. I introduced a similar bill in the previous session, working with Governor Strickland and the Strickland administration. We should have done these kinds of things then. We didn't. We have improved the legislation this time because we had a one-year study undertaken by the Council of State Governments and the Pew Center for the States at the joint request of the then Governor, Speaker, and Senate President. I co-chaired that task force. We have taken their recommendations and added them to the mix. We don't want to end up like California, as to which the U.S. Supreme Court just ruled yesterday, 5-4, that they must outright release 33,000 people out of their prison system because of prison overcrowding there. What we want to do is to reduce prison overcrowding in Ohio and do so in an evidence-based, empirically-based manner. Currently, there is a presumption that felony 4, felony 5 offenders not receive jail time. We are simply tweaking that presumption to make it an outright mandate that they not go to prison on their first offense if it is a nonviolent property or drug offense. That does not substantially impinge on judicial discretion.
Judge Richard Behrens just told us that actually he can see a little bit closer. He could take a little bit more of a magnifying glass to some of these cases and see that perhaps in certain cases somebody has had 15, 20 misdemeanor convictions before that.
Doesn't change the fact that it's their first time under the provisions of this bill. It would be their first time felony conviction.
Well, that's right. But he's saying the essence is it does change the essence of what a judge is allowed to do. If a judge can look at 15 or 20 misdemeanors previously and say, you know what, this guy isn't being cured by sending him to county jail or sending him to doing some kind of local rehabilitation, he needs to go to prison. But he doesn't have that, wouldn't have that discretion.
Well, what Judge Behrens has asked us to do is to allow a third time high level misdemeanor to be charged on the third time as a felon, and that requested amendment is under active consideration. But the bottom line is we simply do not have enough room in our prisons for low-level felony offenders that are convicted of property or drug offenses, and if you want to retain that prison space for the serious, assaultive, predatory, and violent prisoner, then these are the kinds of changes that need to be made. The fact of the matter is, a three-year period of probation, such as is envisioned by this bill, is a more stringent sanction on the offender than 6 months in state prison. 6 months in state prison is nothing more than a short course in crime university for low-level offenders who are then thrown into the general prison population, where they do not learn anything constructive, but rather learn how to become a better criminal. And therefore, that does not promote public safety. Doing that serves no good purpose, and the state simply does not have the funds to continue to build prisons, which are very, very expensive to build and equally expensive to operate.
Senator, is this bill an admission that 5, 10, 20 years ago, when other legislators passed a lot of mandatory sentencing laws and so forth, is this bill an admission that perhaps they went too far?
This bill is a recalibration. Basically, the sentencing structure we have was last put into place in 1995, 1996. In the intervening 15 years, legislators have tinkered with that sentencing structure almost uniformly by raising sentences. So all we are doing through this bill is recalibrating the overall sentencing structure back to 1995-1996 levels. Bill, there's been dozens, and you know it, there's been dozens upon dozens of sentencing enhancement bills that have passed the legislature since 1996. And so we did not appropriate funds to continue to build prisons sufficient to meet our tough-on-crime goals. And so now we find it necessary to recalibrate what our prison system will hold and to, in essence, bring us back to something closer to 1995 sentencing structures.
Senator Seitz, a lot of people in prison are there, particularly at the fourth and fifth degree felony levels, are in prison for drug addiction-related crimes. So what about increasing access to treatment facilities to nip that problem in the bud at the local level?
That's exactly what we're doing by saying that a first-time F4, F5 drug offender is not going to go to state prison and instead will be sentenced to a term of community-controlled probation. We are envisioning that the savings that we get from reducing the prison population will be reinvested in local programs, including treatment.
Who will pay for those programs?
DRC.
There's a funding component in the bill then to manage that.
The funding component actually remains part of the budget bill. The Senate Bill 10, House Bill 86 deals not with appropriations, but rather with the mechanics of the sentencing changes. But there was a good reason why our one-year-long task force was called the Justice Reinvestment in Ohio Project. The operative word was reinvestment. We are not simply going to pocket the savings that we reap from this bill. We are going to reinvest a portion of those savings in strengthening local probation departments, standardizing training, standardizing the risk assessment instrument that all probation departments will henceforth be required to use, and strengthening treatment programs. Now, if we pass this legislation, it will certainly fall to our friends at DRC, the Department of Corrections, to follow through on these promises. That is an administrative function, but that is certainly the legislative goal, which is that, yes, we are going to reduce prison overcrowding. Yes, we are going to change the sentencing structure in Ohio. Yes, we are going to invest more in programs that have been proven to reduce the rate of repeat offense by giving more prisoners who are in prison the opportunity to get an education or job training while they're in prison. But that's our goal, and it's up to the administration to faithfully implement that goal once we pass the bill.
Senator Seitz, there are a lot of laws on the – well, I guess Ohio is one of 12 or 13 states that does allow ex-felons to eventually vote when they've done their time, but there are a lot of laws on the books now that restrict what an ex-felon can do for a living when they get out and where they can live, for that matter. Right. They can't teach children. They can't barber anymore.
Right.
There's a lot of other laws. What could we change in terms of human rights for ex-felons to help them make it on the outside into lower recidivism?
Absolutely. And frankly, we had a meeting last week on this very subject to try to improve House Bill 86, which currently does address the disqualification from being a barber. Well, that's a small step in the right direction. But we are looking at a wholesale series of amendments that will deal with the whole question of collateral sanctions. And what we're specifically interested in trying to put into this bill is a provision that a prisoner who has been rehabilitated, as determined by DRC, would get a certificate of rehabilitation, and any employer that hired that person would be immune from liability for negligent hiring if they hired that person, and that's one of the biggest barriers they face. Private employers will not hire ex-cons because they're afraid that if they screw up on the job, the employer will be sued on the theory that you never should have hired this guy in the first place. So that is one of the things we're looking at. We're looking at relieving the collateral sanctions where everyone who has been convicted of a drug offense loses their driver's license, even if they were not driving while under the influence of drugs. We're looking at relaxing the requirements that people who fail to pay child support lose their driver's license. It's tough to pay that child support if you have no means of getting to and from your job. All these questions, which are generally grouped into the technical term collateral sanctions, remains a subject of active discussion among the House and Senate Criminal Judiciary Committee chairman and the sponsors of House Bill 86 and Senate Bill 10.
Senator, this is Alan Johnson. Something I rarely say, but I respect the position you took in kind of drawing the line on the sand on this bill. I'm wondering when and what kind of turned your mind and that we really need to reverse the tough on crime because we can't afford it anymore. It's probably not the right thing to do. It's not working. When did that happen, and was there anything specific that happened in your experience that kind of turned you onto this path?
That's an excellent question, because two things happened. I come from Hamilton County, which is Cincinnati, which is generally regarded as a very law and order place. Not once but twice in the last 10 years, the voters of Hamilton County, law and order people, turned down the request from our county commissioners and our sheriff to provide funding to build a new jail because our county jail was severely overcrowded. And I thought to myself at the time, if these law and order folks are not willing to put their money where their mouth is, we're going to have to look at other alternatives to deal with this problem. So that got me interested in the issue. The second thing that happened is, as we debate legislation in our respective caucuses, it never ceases to amaze me that people pay great attention to the cost of legislation, except when it came to criminal legislation. We would get reports from the Legislative Service Commission that this particular sentencing enhancement bill or that would cost the Department of Corrections tens of millions of dollars running out into the out years, and people would be completely oblivious to that. People, the same people who would throw a fit at spending an extra $500,000 or $1 million on some other good cause would be completely oblivious to the fact that we are sacking DRC with woeful burdens in the out years, and they said, well, let somebody else worry about that. And I thought to myself, now this has got to stop, because we cannot continue putting 10 pounds in a 5-pound bag. It defies the laws of physics, and if we're not careful, we'll end up right where the U.S. Supreme Court issued its order yesterday on California. 33,000 people must now be immediately released from the California prison system. And that was a 5-4 decision of the Supreme Court, just came down yesterday.
Right. Senator, it's often in an election campaign, a heated, controversial election. Sometimes it's powerful for somebody, one politician, to accuse another of being soft on crime. Has there been any agreement with party officials, the Democratic and Republican Party, on this to say, look, if you vote for this bill that Senator Seitz is pushing, we all promise not to accuse the other candidate, the other guy, of being soft on crime?
There's no such agreement to my knowledge, but I'm very, very sympathetic to your point of view there. And what we've done, we have a 95-2 vote coming out of the Ohio House of Representatives. We have bills, both bills, the House bill and the Senate bill, have bipartisan support, lead co-sponsors, one a Democrat, one a Republican in each chamber. And I think if you're going to do something like this, you need to proceed in a bipartisan way. That's one of the reasons why I agreed to help Governor Strickland on this project over 2 years ago. And And I'm delighted that Governor Kasich is going to follow through on that same legislation. So this is something that needs bipartisan support in order to be successful. Don't want to turn it into a political football. That's not to say somebody won't try to do it, but I think the public is slowly realizing, as witness what I said about jail spending in Hamilton County, that we cannot continue this shoot the jaywalkers attitude in the name of being tough on crime, because the public is simply not willing to fund all of that as they have in the past.
The public hasn't been very willing to fund treatment facilities either, though.
You make a good point. Too many of the public want all of the government services they want, and they want them all for free without paying taxes. That is a fundamental conundrum of 21st century America. We're trying to follow what national experts are telling us is the appropriate thing to do. We're working with the Supreme Court, with the Judicial Conference, with state administrative agencies. We're trying to do this right and let the political consequences fall where they may. But it's been a very exciting adventure, and it's something that I'm very proud of having been involved in, because this is life-changing stuff. If we are able to reduce the rate of recidivism, reduce the rate of repeat offense, that will be a tremendous public safety dividend. And, of course, the savings that we receive from reducing this terrible prison overcrowding is nothing to sneeze at either.
Senator, is this going to happen? I mean, is this going to be passed and signed into law after 3 years of in the gin mill, so to speak?
Well, I certainly hope so. I'm heartened by the 95-2 vote coming out of the House. I believe that the governor put most of this stuff in the budget bill, which is a strong signal of his support. And I'm optimistic that the Senate will act in tandem with our budget deliberations, and because this is pretty important, it's at the very top of the DRC's wish list, and prison spending, prisons in the justice system, are certainly in the top four items of what we spend money on in Ohio, so we almost have to do it.
Senator Seitz, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Enjoyed it very much.
Senator Bill Seitz, he is a Republican from Ohio's 8th Senate District. I also want to say thanks to Alan Johnson of the Columbus Dispatch. Alan, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely.
And Bill Cohen, he is a correspondent for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Bill, thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.